can't believe that I've got an athlete going to the Olympics. It is just unbelievable. I'm absolutely buzzing for Alex, and I'm looking forward to seeing her racing in Tokyo. It's just really good to see her happy again, and it'll just be a great experience for both of us to see her racing in Tokyo. And like I said, just really looking forward to it.
Hello and welcome back to the Sunday podcast. I'm Ollie Lum, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Matt Seddon. Wow, so that was this week's guest, Andy Henderson, on his thoughts around Alex Bell making the team to Tokyo.
Yep, we got to say a huge congratulations to them both, really. I'm so happy for Alex. She is literally, you know, one of the fighters of the sport. And this interview that you're about to hear with Andy Henderson was actually pre-recorded, so his emotions are still pretty raw. We obviously did touch on the British champs and Alex finishing up in fifth as well, and his emotions were very raw on a topic, wouldn't you agree, Ollie? So it's great to hear him with a buzz in his voice, and I think he's most happy to see Alex happy again, because, you know, after all setbacks athletes face, I think it can take a while to build back up. So to have your emotions just change in a day is pretty amazing.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it makes actually for a really interesting pod, because you get kind of Andy's perspective on it before he knows that Alex has made the team. So hopefully it'll be a really interesting listen for you guys. Just before we get into the pod, we just want to highlight some of the races going down recently and upcoming as well, because some of the stuff's been crazy since the British champs. We obviously had Monaco Diamond League last night. We saw some crazy times. Laura Muir and Gemma Riki, 156. Mental. Just after, obviously, Alex going into the team, just after Laura declares she's just going to run the 15 at Tokyo. So some crazy things going down for British athletes.
Yep, absolutely bonkers. And I don't know if any of you watched the whole meet. Go back and watch the 3,000 meter steeplechase if you want to see torture, mate. They're ringing the bell a lap early. This is like the Champions League of athletics, basically. And the officials, you know, had a bit of a mistake, rung the bell a lap early on the steeple. Poor Kenyans are kicking like crazy. Monica had everything as per. I mean, that is an incredible one-day meet. It really is. But yeah, so that was Monaco. What meets have we got coming up, Lum? We've got...
We've got an SAL tomorrow. So I'll be going down to Bracknell, helping the club out. I'll be running a 15 match, just going to be
just chatting
in the fans, in the stadium.
Yeah, I mean, outdoor fans are allowed now at the SALs, thank God, so I can really get there and back all them Bracknell AC athletes. But yeah, so we got that, bro. And then Tuesday, look out for the Gateshead Diamond League. I think that's an evening meet as well, the Gateshead Diamond League on Tuesday night. So that will be the last time you see athletes run, probably for Tokyo.
And Wednesday's Birmingham Uni Open. Yep. So there's a mile and a 3K, I think. I think there's some pretty big names in those. And then Saturday is the MK 5,000 meter special. So that's the club I kind of grew up with. So just a big shout out to them. And it should be a good meet. Like I'm running myself, but the like A races and stuff, men's and women's, have some really stacked fields. So guys, get down and watch that if you can. I think your spectators are allowed for that. There's also a live stream going down on YouTube and things like that. So kind of have a look out for that. We got some of our past guests running as well. So I think Jack Rowe and Jake Smith going in the men's race, and then Jenny Nesbitt's going in the women's race as well.
Yep. I'll be there as per, chatting away and
doing an Instagram live, Matt.
I'll be doing Instagram live interviews, actually, hopefully, if I can get on the track and just catch up with you.
I better do something then, so I get some airtime on our own Instagram.
Yeah, what are you going for, mate? Sub 14 or sub 13, 30?
We'll see. I'll wear some cheat spikes, maybe.
But yeah,
I'm trying to sneak in some next percents, and then we'll be allowed some.
Well, actually, we could say to the listeners, we have rumours that the night spikes, we think, will be dropping on Thursday, right?
Yeah, Thursday or Friday, I think.
Want some brand new Dragonflies or some brand new Victories? I don't know why we're like pumping up Nike, but
I say that I was gonna say they do seem to be the best spikes, but have a look at some of them Asics athletes at Monaco.
Oh yeah, Lizzie Bird's 822 national.
Yeah, record, so. Lizzie Bird, 922, mate.
No, 922, man. Yeah,
and obviously Katir was wearing the Asics spikes. You can say what you want about him, but So they must be pretty fast, them things. Yeah. Obviously Ailish wears them as well. So
Jesus. So and then, mate, one last thing. It's obviously today's the day. football's coming home. So get out for your run, rest up, get on the beers, and enjoy the game.
Yeah, and pray for that emergency bank holiday on Monday.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, basically, when you're hungover on Monday, just put the Sunday podcast on and go for your little trot. Instead, you can do it on Monday.
Yeah, real talk. Right, enjoy the ep, guys. See you next week. Yeah, well, first of all, Andy, just welcome to the podcast. Thanks for coming on. Would you mind just giving us an introduction to yourself and kind of your coaching role at Leeds Beckett?
Yeah, so I'm Andy Henderson. I'm head of athletics at Leeds Beckett University. I've been in Leeds since 2006 and got the head of athletics role probably, I think it was about 2014. Just basically since then, just been trying to set up the endurance group, really, because that's where my speciality lies, as well as looking after the full athletics program and trying to provide a program for the students, you know, and making sure that they've got the necessary event group coaches in place as well. So that's about it, really.
Yeah, I mean, you're very well known now, but how did you, you know, what drew you to like the distance races? Did you run before, you know, distance wise and coaching, you know, what drew you into that coaching role? And then obviously over to Leeds and where you're excelling now.
I'll start at the beginning, really. I mean, I grew up in South Africa. So my parents immigrated from the UK when I was very young. I did a fair bit of running in South Africa. When I was training at like university in South Africa, I at the same time started doing my coaching qualification. And then started picking up some jobs in schools, just coaching while I was still actually competing. And then eventually came over to the UK. My qualifications didn't really count for much that I did in South Africa. So I had to start all over again. It wasn't really until, because it was 1997 when I came over. So I just drifted back into playing football and, left athletics for a while. So it was only when I came to Leeds in 2006 to study that I joined the endurance group. And back then we just had a head of athletics that did everything. So basically shot put, coaching, sprints coaching, you were all there at the same time, basically. And you were given the session and then you'd all just crack on. So I thought I'd help him out and said, I'm happy to take the endurance group. Since then never really looked back and just picked up coaching roles as well, working for Leeds City Council, just trying to gain experience, working in schools, still doing the endurance coaching at the university. And that's how it basically all started, and then just really kicked on from there.
Now that's so interesting. It seems like it almost kind of just evolved organically. Was there any sort of turning point or moment you could think of that you thought, wow, I really want to kind of pursue the coaching side, or was it just that kind of gradual over time?
No, I kind of knew that I wasn't going to get any quicker at 1500. Naturally, I just didn't have those fast twitch fibers that you need. I just thought I'd probably be better off coaching, and I kind of enjoyed it, really, more so in a sense. I still get a similar kind of buzz from coaching athletes and going to events, watching them as I did when I was an athlete as well. It was very easy for me to go into coaching. The more I got into it, I mean, like you said, I mean, not many people, I don't think anybody knew me back then when I first started, and I was really starting from scratch. And the biggest thing is I started with kids as well, almost thinking that I'm going to create my own group here, working with the kids. And then, as they get older, you know, they develop as well. So that's how I look to progress my coaching. And I wanted to have a really good endurance setup in Leeds. So to get to the point where we are now is basically what I was always looking for.
Yeah, no, that's so interesting. Like, I guess it's quite a broad question, really. We wanted to know, like, just like you had to start, just I guess for the start of this podcast, like, what do you think makes a good coach, or like, what are the most important things?
Yeah, I mean, that's so many things, really. I mean, for me, is actually getting to know the individual. I think that's the key thing, because every athlete is different, you know, anybody can prescribe a training session, but can you also deal with the personality as well that comes with it? Because yeah, fine, they can do the session, but you know, ultimately you're also looking to get a very good performance out of them, and part of the coaching is also just making sure that mentally they're in a good place as well, and being able to deal with things like that. So for me, the key thing is making sure, first and foremost, is that the athlete is happy. And if the athlete is happy, then we'll get the performances we're looking for.
Mm. What's fascinating is, like you say, when you first went to Leeds in 06, there was, you know, one coach trying to coach everybody. And now, you know, you've, you know, headed it up and been able to form such an elite environment, so much so that you've now got like the Leeds Talent Hub as well up in Leeds. But how did you go about doing that, you know, from sort of 2010s to now, you know, the past sort of 6-7 years, how did you go about slowly changing the dynamic of the group to what I presume, and you know, outsiders, you know, when we see stuff on social media and stuff, it looks like a very elite environment. So how did you change that from being, you know, quite an amateur state?
I mean, we've always looked to, so even when I started with the kids, we've always looked in a sense to encourage, you know, just our club runners to be able to at least warm up with our elite level athletes and be able to do that side of things. So we always try to integrate everybody in the group in some way or form that they were doing something together. Mm. So we've always done that. I think it's only realistically properly changed since, you know, COVID kicked in. And now, you know, it has become a little bit more difficult to have everybody together. So we don't have as much of an integration, you know, from a club side of things with the those that you'd see as an elite side of things. But I've always tried to just get everybody to do bits together. And even if it meant in some sessions as well, that especially for some of the youngsters, they did bits of sessions with some of the other guys as well, or parts of reps as well. So, you know, and in some ways, it's also then given that club run some inspiration in a sense to then also be able to kick on. And that's what we try to do with the students as well, as much as possible, get them to train in and around the guys that we've got at that top level as well, to try and really push them as, on as well, and try and encourage them to perform. I mean, it's always, I've always tried to find ways of getting people always to try and work together, no matter what level they're at.
Yeah, I mean, that's key, isn't it? Because then, you know, success breeds success. And you know, like you say, university runners or club runners, they see, you know, training with people like Alex Bell, Phil Sesman, stuff like that, then they almost want to emulate them, and they quickly catch on to, you know, their mannerisms and how they go about training and how they approach training and races and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the big thing is athletes talk when they go for a warm-up or a cool-down. So when you've got a youngster with a senior athlete like Phil, for example, they can go along and just ask questions they won't necessarily ask me, you know. And you know, it's the same with the female athletes, you know, being able to talk to somebody like a Laura Waitman, maybe even on a cool down or a warm-up, you know, it helps as well, just getting an athlete's perspective on things as well. That's why I found it quite important at times, just to be able to do that warm up or cool down with those guys.
Does it help like a bit logistically, I guess, as well? Because we were going through a Para 10 earlier, and like the amount of athletes you actually coach is huge. And I guess like you say, like enabling them to all kind of work in together, does that help with actually managing that side of things?
It does, but I try and individualize things as much as possible as well. I'm quite lucky that I'm in the role that I'm in, so I can spend most of my days, you know, certain days in the week, our session days, more specifically, say Tuesdays, I could spend the whole day out of the track now, just because I'm staggering sessions, because I'm trying to individualize things as much as possible. And that's, you know, another thing now that's made it a lot harder for me, because I'm trying to individualize things a lot more than I used to. It is difficult you're coaching large numbers, not gonna lie. Some sessions people can do bits of others, you know, sessions as well, just trying to make that a little bit easier, you know, for myself. But yeah, it is difficult having large numbers. Yeah.
I think when we talk about individualizing as well, do you find yourself having to individualize emotions as well? For example, if someone's, you know, on a real high as a coach, you're going to be naturally excited as well. And then if someone's going through a bit of a rough patch, you know, do you have to kind of figure out how to act around, you know, different people as well as just obviously tailoring training?
Yeah. I mean, we have breakdowns within sessions. So, you know, you're then having to deal with that individual, you know, just trying to have, you know, get them back on either doing the session or adjusting the session for them. And then at times the rest of the group is just having to crack on while I'm having to, you know, deal with that. But yeah, each person is different. That's why I think, like I said earlier, it's important as a coach that you're able to deal with situations like that, because each individual is different. And when things don't go to plan in sessions, you do have those breakdowns more often than you'd like as well. It's part and parcel of having that big group is being able to deal with the personalities as well. So,
and I guess that's something you've just learned over time from experience, rather than, you know, that sounds like it can't necessarily be taught, that side of the coaching role.
I don't think it can be taught, but you can learn yourself just by experiencing those different personalities and just getting, I think that's why it's key to get to know the athletes. And sometimes it does take a bit of time. So you've just got to be prepared to be patient, and then also just also let the athlete know that they need to be patient as you try and learn what that individual's like and the kind of stuff that makes them kind of happy, like I also said before, so that they get the performances that they need or would like out of the season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, within that kind of big group of athletes as well, you've also got quite a few like event differences, I guess, as well, because although it's all distance running, you've got like people running 800s, and then you've got a few like I think transitioning to the marathon now as well. How do you kind of manage that? Do you have like a, not a preference I guess, but do you find any like easier to do in terms of like setting the training and things like that, or like how does it differ between event groups?
Yeah, I mean, I find it easier to set more of the distance side of stuff, so you know, your 5k, 10k, that side of stuff I find a lot easier. The 800 is probably the hardest one, just because you can get somebody that's a 4.8 runner, or you can get somebody that's the 8.15, or you know, that side of things as well. So just trying to find the things that work for those individuals, it can be a little bit harder. I also find that their personalities are also a little bit more difficult as well. So they are people that actually want things now, basically. So when they turn up to a first race, they're expecting something special and a PB straight off. Personality-wise, I think they also can be the hardest ones to deal with. Also within sessions, sometimes they don't like to be beaten either. So again, you're dealing with a fallout potentially as well, or a strop. So yeah, it's more those guys. So definitely, say from 1500 meters and up, I'd find a lot easier to work with, because again, they're quite easy to just go, well, I'll take this rep, and then you get the next one, that kind of thing, or you know, and they just crack on with the session. And even when they turn up to race each other at races, they're quite supportive of each other. So yeah, not as competitive, I think, as some of the 800 guys.
We should see, how about that? A bit of egos and stuff on the shorter distances.
Yeah, so yeah. You can say that. Like, why do you think that is? Do you think it's, I guess, like, do you think the 800 runners don't feel that kind of distance running culture, I guess, that is all kind of about sharing workloads and things?
Potentially, you know, I think it's that. And yeah, it's, they're almost like sprinters, I guess, in a sense as well, you know. I'd say that, you know, their personalities are, just completely different. They can be more of an extrovert type person as well, really, compared to some of your distance runners. But, you know, it's a challenge, but it's a good challenge. And at times it can be hard, but, you know, we get through it and we find ways to work through it. But it would never stop me really from working with them. And I do enjoy that side of stuff. But I think I've not properly done the marathon side of stuff. So, you know, moving into that kind of area, again, you know, that'll be a new challenge for me as well. Especially with, you know, you've interviewed Phil earlier this year and you know that he's, you know, looking to move that way. So, yeah, so that'll be another challenge for me, and a new one, so which I'm looking forward to, and we'll see how that changes, or whether, you know, personality wise Phil is still the same kind of person as well with that new challenge.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are looking forward to Phil's debut.
Yeah,
it's already being hyped up now, but yeah, I kind of agree, you know, 800 runners and some 15, they do remind me of the people who sort of thrive off beating others, whereas in the 5K, I think people almost accept defeat a little bit easier, because I think there's a little bit more in 800s and 15s. I think there's a bit more tactics involved, and I think each person knows on their day they can beat one another, whereas I think in the longer distance, it tends to just go by the form book a little bit more.
Yeah, you know, that could be true, but yeah, and there's maybe a little bit more aggression in the 8-15 side of stuff as well for people. Whereas you don't need to, you've got more time in the longer distances as well to be able to do certain stuff as well. Whereas in the shorter stuff, you don't. So you do need that kind of, I'd say aggressive side of things as well, really, to be able to achieve what you want at those distances in the 8 and the 15. So, yeah.
Yeah, just wanted to touch upon a kind of how do you get athletes to like buy into your program that you have? You obviously, like, you kind of seem to get new athletes in every year that seem to, like, obviously go into university, and part of that, I'm sure, is because of your reputation, the reputation of the group up there. I guess how do you get people to buy in, and how's that changed over the years? Because obviously, as you mentioned, probably quite unknown, like when it first started. So how has that kind of progressed? Has it got easier to get people to just go and buy into the program?
I think it's a little bit harder now, because I think the level of athlete that we're getting is, you know, it's better. Mm-hmm. So in some ways they still want to have links with their home coach as well. So it's just trying to find the best way of working that side of stuff. And generally most of the coaches are quite supportive in what we're doing, and they're quite happy while the athlete is at university for them to just crack on with our program. And what I like to do is generally meet the athletes before they come, and also have that conversation with the coaches as well, just to, you know, to see what they have been doing and then just give them an idea of the kind of stuff that we do as well, and trying to find the best way of getting things to work for that athlete when they come to university. Whereas before, these athletes were coming as club athletes and not having a coach as such, and it was a lot easier because then it was a new experience for them to come to uni and then almost be an athlete full time in a sense, and it was a bit easier for them to buy into the program, most of them wouldn't have accessed a gym or done a proper circuit type training session as well, so you know it was exciting for them. I'd say early on it was a lot easier, but now we're just having to be a little bit more strategic about how we do it as well, and also just try and keep links with home coaches as well.
Yeah, because I think, you know, for us in this day and age, it just seems like, you know, people are open to a lot more stuff online, and, you know, people tend to know, whereas before, like, you wouldn't know what the training group, you know, 2 hours away was doing, but now you do tend to get an idea of, you know, what the local, what the rival clubs and stuff are doing and how they train. So it's interesting to hear you, you know, talk about people buying into the programs by just approaching, you know, speaking to them before, you know, they go to university, so they can understand, and when they go there, they know that's like the right decision they're doing, and they want to do that training rather than, you know, getting there and then questioning it once they're there, you know, because that's too late then.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the one thing that I try and get the athletes to buy into is the program. I don't, as a university, we don't have a lot of money either, so it's not like I can give and promise athletes big scholarships on that side of things. So but one thing I can do is give them a good program and support them as best I can in their athletics. So if they're happy enough to come for the coaching side of things, then that's the biggest thing for me. And that is our key selling point. And I think the biggest positive now as well is actually having the talent hub. And I'm now supported by other coaches that we have as well through that. So with Helen Clitheroe and Ian Mitchell, who's been in Leeds for a while as well. So he works with the Brownlee brothers on that side. So he's part of our coaching staff as well now. So yeah, that's also helped. So it just means that we've got more time to individualize things and give more time to athletes as well, just because there are more of us.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, on that note, how does a coach, you know, for coaches and maybe athletes who are self-coaching themselves listening, you know, how do you go about planning a season? Because I think often this is something overlooked, you know, by athletes, and, you know, because they kind of just expect to be in the shape come summer. But obviously it takes a lot more than that. So how do you sort of go about planning a season, or maybe more than a season, you know, 18 months or 2 years? You know, where do you start, basically?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite easy when you just look at a season in a sense. So again, depending on the individual as to what they want to do, if they're going to stick to cross country and then go from that into the summer, then generally that's probably the most simple one in a sense for me. I think the harder one is the ones that looking to do indoors. So it's just trying to find the best way that we're going to get something out of the indoors and then also get something going out into the summer. But generally I just work off a good winter, loads of, you know, grass type sessions, 10K type sessions, 5K type sessions, just really trying to build a lot of strength, working on, you know, in couple of gym sessions a week. Some would even have a circuit session as well on top of that, especially early on into December. And then depending on which direction people want to go, then we'll change the emphasis a little bit for those that are going indoors especially. But otherwise, some carry on through the winter until the summer. And then as we get nearer to the summer, it's just then start putting more emphasis on individualizing what people want to do as to whether they're looking to go longer or shorter on the track. And then, yeah, so just trying to, you know, get legs moving, basically, really, after a lot of strong base work as such in the winter.
Makes sense. And then I guess, should we touch upon it now? Just like British, we'll talk about the British champs a little bit. And because I'm just quite interested to see a coach's opinion of how they approach, you know, a national championships and going into when so much is at stake, obviously is well documented. You obviously coach Alex Bell in the 800. How do you, you know, before the race, you know, what are you, you know, how are you dealing with Alex? Do you go in with a set race plan and stuff like that?
We try to. It's we. I suppose I find the championships a lot harder, especially this one was, because there was more pressure. I'm trying to make the team, but yeah, it's again. It's I don't know how to say, but it's. I mean, we spoke about. I mean, for the first time, if we'll go into the championship, for example. So you know, this year, Alex has got a lot of confidence from what she achieved before the championships and being able to realize that she could actually run as quick as she could. So that gave her confidence. So she ran a great heat on the Saturday. So that was planned. So basically it was either going to be, so we basically had a plan A and a plan B in a sense. So it's if she ended up the front, then to do what she did, just take control of it and just and she did that one. Whereas the other one would be if she didn't end up on the front, then it was a case of just being on whoever's shoulder and then just doing what she needed to do, really. So yeah, so that worked fine. But yeah, it was a little bit more harder going into the final. We had a chat about it. But yeah, it's I think in some ways it we just looked to try and see what others were going to do, and especially in specific individuals, and then try and move with them, really, which, you know, Alex tried to do. I've not been able to really, since the race, be able to watch it back to properly analyze it, but you know, once I get over, you know, what's happened, in a sense, I'll have a proper look at it. But I have, you know, caught some glimpses of bits on social media, and then also watching the race myself. But yeah, it's whether we probably she did too much in following Laura when she made a move going into the home straight, coming into the bell, really. So yeah, but those were Laura was one that we wanted to watch and try and move with. So that was the plan, really. But whether we just did too much that too early in the race, and yeah, 200 to go, it was just too difficult then for Alex to find another gear, having run in lane 3 for you know, almost 200 meters or more, really. So yeah,
I think it's I think it's so tricky in these races where so many of you are so close, like 6 of them 159 or below, or maybe even 7 of them, you know, going in with a time of sub 2 minutes. And like you said, when you just, not only do you have to have a race plan yourself, you have to consider what, you know, 5 or 6 other people in the race might do and how that will affect your race.
Yeah, I think, you know, the biggest thing this year as well is nerves. And being able to control that side of stuff going into championships, because I think that saps a lot of energy as well. So it's just being able to channel your thoughts as well going into a champ, so that you're not getting too fixated on it, and being able to relax so that you're saving as much energy going into those races. And I do think that's a big thing as well, just because there's so much at stake as well, really. Because it is the Olympics, you know, that you want to go to. So, yeah. But, I mean, normally when I do speak to athletes, we generally try and have a plan A, plan B, and a plan C. But you've also sometimes got to rely on just having that kind of race savviness as well, really. So sometimes none of those plans will work out as such. And it's just being able to then yourself being able to analyze what's happening and then what is going to be the best move.
Mm.
Yeah, no, it's so interesting listening to you talk about it, because it, I mean, it just shows you like the margins. Like, say take that 800 for example. Like all these girls are in pretty similar shape, and it just comes down to, I guess, the final margins. And then on the, I guess, Olympic stage, it's another level again of that. And I think it just highlights to, I guess, our listeners, just it's so different to your everyday sort of training for a race where you're just simply trying to get in some sort of shape. There's so many more layers to it. With that, like, how do you kind of keep athletes on almost like a positive path, like after setbacks? And the same with like when people do really well, how do you keep them grounded, I guess? Because if people are having really good seasons, sometimes they get a bit ahead of themselves, I'm sure. So what's the how do you approach that?
I think, again, it's just being able to know the individual and what they need. So, I do either make the effort of trying to arrange to meet up with that individual to then just chat things through, you know, especially when things aren't going well. And then trying to, together, try and work on something that we can, you know, try and pick things up with, really. I don't always want to go with just what I think. So I also want to listen to the athlete. Every year you go through all the, you know, people not having a great season or just not great races, or things aren't going to plan. So, I just spend time with that individual to try and get it right. And then, I mean, for people that are doing well, it's just making them realize as well that, you know, depending on the achievement, you're still not at the top kind of thing. So, you know, it's just being able to just kind of like control your excitement, because, you know, it's people enjoy PVs and things as well, but it's again being able to cope with when they don't go well as well, then that time will come. So and that's when I think people learn the most as well, is when things aren't going well, and being able to make that bounce back.
On that note, I mean, the next few years are huge anyway. You know, there seems to be plenty of opportunity for the athletes coming through the Leeds Talent Hub to go to global championships, Europeans, mm-hmm. Commonwealths. You know, so do you start thinking about that now, or is it a bit too soon?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's a little bit soon. I'm just trying to, you know, take the championship at a time. But I do know, you know, next year we've got the Europeans, Commonwealths, the Worlds, and then the following year you've got the Worlds, and then the following year you've got the Olympics and Europeans. So, you know, it's a busy time, and even busier than it has been before. So, yeah, the ultimate goal is to make the championships. But I think for now, it's just to try and focus on one championship at a time. Because for some of them, it's still a learning curve as well. So especially for juniors. So I've got an athlete going to the European juniors next week. So, for him, it's a, you know, first GB vest, but a learning experience. But then, you know, next year could he go to the Commonwealths, for example, as another stepping stone. It's, you know, which we have spoken about, but I do want him just to focus on this one first, and then we'll see what we can do moving towards next year. But yeah, for somebody like him as a junior, you do have a basic plan in place, really, for, you know, 4 or 5 years, really, looking at various championships. And I think ultimately for him, you know, again, it'd be the Olympics in in Paris, really.
Yeah, no, it's interesting you say that. I think kind of being a university coach, you almost have a unique challenge in that there are, for the guys coming through, guys and girls coming through, there's so many different competitions when you're kind of, I guess, 20, 21, 22 sort of age, that you've got European under 23s, you've potentially got your senior champs, you've got Bucks championships, you've got pressures maybe from your club to go and do those sorts of things. How do you sort of cope with that? Because I think, yeah, the guys and girls who are university age, there's just so many things coming at them from all directions.
Yeah, it's a difficult one. I mean, a good example is somebody like Phil. If he could race every day, he'd race every day. So, you know, that's the way he is. He wants to do everything. He loves the relays. I think he can't wait to get the relays going again, you know. So, yeah. So it's like, I already know that I'm going to have to find a way of incorporating the relays in his marathon training, for example, you know. So you're just trying to find ways of keeping the athletes happy and being able to get them to do those events that they want to do. And that's why I generally like them to be able to give me an idea of what they would like to do. And then I'll get that. I can have a look at it. And then together we can say, well, okay, yeah, this is realistic. That's realistic. But do you really need to be, you know, want to do that, for example, because it could affect something else that we're looking to do as a main goal as such. But yeah, it's just trying to manage things. And sometimes, you know, some of the races you just got to incorporate as part of your training as well. But yeah, I do find that some people sometimes overdo things and then maybe don't get the performances that they, you know, deserve as such. And then again, it's just trying to get them to understand that they don't need to do every single race. And let's rather just build towards a main target as such, really, and just incorporate some of these other events like, you know, your Bucks Cross compared to doing a European Cross or something, you know. So yeah.
Nice. As uni coach, do you feel yourself putting much impetus on the club scene? Because obviously the club scene seems to be, you know, pretty much dying out these days, and I feel like with unis getting much stronger than they used to be. You know, we're seeing talent hubs in Leeds, Birmingham, and Cardiff, and obviously London have got theirs, and you know, and I think athletes are naturally just more drifting towards going to university and being a part of that setup and then basically staying there as well. I mean, you've probably experienced a load of people go through Leeds University and still stay in the area and still train there. So do you find yourself not really, you're not too involved in the club system or?
No, I find it easier to just do what I'm doing as such, because that way I'm able to coach anybody as such. So if they come from different clubs, then fine. You know, I don't generally get involved too much with a specific club. But I know that for Leeds, we've been quite lucky in that the students that we've had now have graduated. And because, you know, training in Leeds is so good, they just don't leave Leeds. Mm. So they then decide to stay in Leeds, find a job, and then, of course, end up running for Leeds City. I think, which is fine. I don't, you know, push for them to do that. And everybody does it for themselves, really. So, I'm just happy coaching the way that I do and happy to coach any athlete. It is difficult, especially with track and field, you know, trying to get the guys to go and compete for clubs. And I think it's also to do with the level of competition within those leagues and stuff as well. And I think this year's made harder in the sense of, you know, people not being here to compete for their clubs. So like the British leagues. So one of the athletes has been doing a couple of those because I like them to do that in preparation for the juniors in a sense. The competition wasn't as good as I'd known it from a couple of years ago. So when Phil was doing it on a regular basis. I don't know where it's going to go, you know, next season. But I think it's definitely, like you said, it needs something to happen to try and encourage, you know, some of the better athletes to compete.
Do you have any thoughts yourself on how the club scene could change and try and make it better for athletics in the UK, or do you not really have a take on it?
I don't really have a take on it as such. You know, I don't know whether I should be pushing it a little bit more and trying to encourage people to compete, especially in the British league side of stuff, the top end of side of things, because I think, you know, especially with some of the way that some people have raced this year, when it's come to championships, I think being able to do the tactical side of stuff, I do think we'd learn a lot from it as well, because at the moment we're just going into races where we're focused on times. I think it's always going to be like that. Everybody just seems to be more focused on people running fast than being able to just go out there and win a race for your club.
Agreed. I mean, kind of goes back to what we were saying earlier. I'm not sure how much people care to winning and losing as much as they do setting a PB now. And I guess that's kind of always been the nature of the sport. But I feel like it's even more sort of at the stage where, you know, people would quite happily finish 10th in a race in comparison to first if it meant they ran a good time.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. When I have the guys going into BMC races and stuff that they do, I try and encourage them to focus on racing the race. Don't worry about the clock. And, you know, if you win the race, generally you'd be running a fast time. So, yeah, I do encourage them, rather than looking at a watch, let's see what you can do. Just race it. See if you can podium. You know, those are the key things to try and focus on in these races. But you always know that it's going to be quick from the word go because you've got a pacemaker in the race. But then when you don't have anybody doing that, then sometimes people just don't know what they're doing. So
yeah, spot on. Do you do any sort of different pace work as a coach, you know, going into championships and stuff? Because I know a lot of people are so finely tuned to just racing or operating at that, like that PB rhythm, because that's what they train at week in, week out, you know. Just wondered, like, do you throw the pace around for your athletes?
You know, we do, going into championship races, we do different pace work, yeah, for sure. So I've actually got a session that I'm going to do with the athlete that's going next week. So I see it as a key session tomorrow in a sense. So basically, I'm just going to get a whistle out and he'll basically be looking to pick up the pace as I blow the whistle, for example. So just from a steady pace in a sense. I see pace work even throughout the years as a key part of what we're doing as well, just because paces change significantly depending on the level of racing that you do. You watch world-class races and you see, you know, 5K, 10K races and people finishing 51, 52 second last 400s, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, it's, you try and structure your sessions around, you know, how races kind of go as such. So, you know, you're working at a steady race pace kind of thing, but then can you pick up from that towards the back end of races? So, yeah, and then, of course, being able to do some stuff in the middle of sessions as well, and sometimes starting quicker, all that kind of thing as well. So depending on the races that they are doing as well, because I also work with triathletes and there's different ways that we look at how they come out of their transition as well from the bike onto the run, and how we go about doing stuff on that side of things as well. So, yeah, I always structure some sessions around, yeah, what those people can expect within races.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting on that kind of training, just before we finish, like, just wanted to get an idea of, like, I know you coach like lots of different distances and events and things, but say like one of our listeners wanted to do like a typical Andy Henderson workout, do you have anything that's like your bread and butter, I guess?
Yeah. It's a hard one. I mean, sessions that I used to like personally, mm-hmm. and I kind of generally go, it's a go-to as an easy session, is like 400s really. So whether you do them of 60 seconds, you know, it's for some of the guys like 10 fours of a minute, or I think even Phil enjoys it, doing 20 fours of a minute, being able to do those, you know, and those are supposedly, you know, I see as an easier type session as well. But yeah, I'd say that for me, that's just a simple session, but an easy one, and one that I enjoyed doing myself as well as an athlete. And I think the guys do as well. I think yesterday we did 400s yesterday, and it was off 60 seconds, but we decided to, I didn't want them to go as hard as normal. I just wanted to kind of make it easier. But in the end, we did make it a little bit harder, because we decided to do a 200 in 60 seconds and then go into your 400 as well. Most of them seem to enjoy that side of things as well. But when I asked them to go easier, their faces were a bit like, well, I don't really want to do it. But then we managed to negotiate that they could then actually do a 200 float as such in 60 seconds, and then do the 400 a little bit slower than normal. So yeah,
I think it's because for that 10-4 session, you know, I think athletes always know they're in really good shape if they can like do it and tick off, you know, almost race pace on it. I just wanted to say as well, you know, you've done such a good job at coming from, you know, just a university coach, you've now just like merged into the role of, you know, you're a full-time coach, and there is not many full-time coaches in the UK at all. What do you think the biggest challenges are, you know, for coaches out there? Is it the fact that they're not full-time? Is that a challenge? Do you see that as a challenge, or, you know, or is there other challenges that like you're aware of where, you know, club coaches or part-time coaches, or even you faced, you know, coming up through the coaching ranks?
I suppose the difficult thing is for coaches out there is being able to combine a full-time job to then go and coach on an evening as well. But not only that, though, make time to then also plan for those athletes as well. And that normally takes a fair whack of time as well. So, you know, for me, I could spend many hours a week just trying to prepare for the next week's sessions for all the athletes that I've got. So it's you know, if you're not getting paid and you're doing it, you know, in your own time, I think the problem is making that time, but then also trying to make time for your family as well. And, you know, it's difficult, because I think if I didn't have the role that I had, I'd be getting it in the ear a lot, I think, from my family for not being around, because it does take a hell of a lot of time. And especially when you have to go away as well to championships and you're spending weekends. But on top of that, then also fuel costs, hotel costs, all that side of things as well. And that comes out of your own pocket. I am very lucky. I wake up every day and I love going to work. And I know how lucky I am to be in the situation that I am. I think, you know, if we could have more, you know, even part-time roles as coaches and stuff, I think that would make a difference as well. But like anything, it's just trying to find a way of funding all of that. It's taken me a while, because, I mean, as a university coach, I'm not full time. I'm lucky in the sense that we've got the talent hub, and that's kind of helped me to then also bump up what I've got, because, otherwise, yeah, I wouldn't be in a full time role. Mm. So,
I think you're bang on with some of them points. And it's almost like, what do you think comes first, the athlete or the coach? So it's like, as a governing body, you know, should we start investing in coaches more than, or before we start, you know, investing in athletes? Or is it like an you know, an equal split, because I think at the moment, you know, quite like not much is done as far as coaches are aware of in investing in them. You know, the brilliant thing, you know, this year and I think last year when the talent hubs came about was, like you said, you had permanent coaches like yourself and Luke Gunn that were associated there. So that's like a big step forward.
Yeah, I mean, that's it's a good starting point. And then we've managed to get other coaches. And again, those coaches aren't full time.
No.
So they just got, you know, 2 days a week or 3 days a week kind of thing. So, yeah, it's a starting point. But, yeah, I mean, I'd look to try and invest more in coaches, because I also think that with investing more in coaches, then you're able to then encourage more athletes to come to the sport as well, I think, as well. So if you've got more time and coaches can give more time, then you'd be able to have a group in place, you know, and you know, that group then breeds others. So, yeah, I'd in some ways probably, you know, look at it 50-50, because it is a shared partnership really between athlete and coach as well. And, you know, as much as, you know, the athlete's doing the physical side of stuff, you know, the coach is also doing a lot of the planning side of stuff and also spending time at those sessions to, you know, make sure that the athlete is doing what they need to do in a sense as well. So, yeah, I definitely think that we could do with investing a bit more in coaching for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, same here. I think if coaches get recognized just the way athletes get recognized, I think it would just be a, you know, a knock-on effect, and we just start to see a lot more coaches and put in more time. As a result, you get better athletes, and it would just grow and grow and grow, to be honest.
Well, that's it. I mean, that, you know, the coaches would also have more time then to be able to do things, and then, you know, like the planning side of stuff, and who knows, we'd, you know, get better performances as well, because you're able to spend more time doing that side of things as well. So, yeah, it's something to look at for sure moving forward.
Absolutely.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much it, really.
Yeah, yeah. Just thank you for coming on, and best of luck with the rest of the season for your
athletes. Yeah, no, thank you very much.
Thanks for listening, guys. We hope you enjoyed this week's episode. As always, if you did, please leave us a rating and review on your preferred podcast streaming service, as it really helps us out.